Welcome to the Left of Lansing podcast with your host, Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. A, dare we say, entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how we can best make Michigan's political machine work for the people. And now, live from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's Pat Johnston.
Welcome to another edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. I'm Pat Johnston, creator, writer, and host of this podcast that highlights the hard work by Michigan progressives who are trying to help turn the Great Lakes State into a compassionate, intelligent blue voting bloc for decades to come. Now, it's true, progressives were caught flat-footed during the Reagan Revolution, but after realizing 40-plus years later of how union-busting, trickle-down economics, and extreme white right-wing identity politics have torn down rather than build up our state and the country as a whole, progressives are now fighting back to bring us back to our roots. You can always visit me at leftoflansing.com for additional commentary by yours truly. And if you would like to engage in further conversation, my email, very simple, leftoflansing@gmail.com. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at leftoflansing. And Left of Lansing is also on the Facebook. Just type in Left of Lansing in the search bar and you'll find me there. And I'm still kind of undecided about this whole Instagram thing. I mean, do you think I should have a presence there as well? It seems like even more work on the social media front, but yes, such are the times that we live in, I suppose. I mean, social media is everywhere, or as my wife and the technical advisor to this podcast says, media is everywhere. Hey, coming up, I'm going to talk with one of the co-hosts from one of my favorite Michigan progressive podcasts. Her name is Christine Berry, and she works with Michigan Podcast, and she's my guest this week as we talk about the challenges of getting the progressive message out to the masses while terrestrial radio broadcasting is owned by a conservative corporate culture, a culture that paints we progressives as radical because, you know, we want revolutionary things like economic fairness, quality health care, a decent education, environmental stewardship, and empathy towards others. I know. Radical. Well, Christine Berry is coming up in just a few moments as we'll talk about that and many other things that are happening in Lansing. And I hope she won't mind, but Christine wishes that I could provide a more daily podcast. When I started this whole project last winter, I worked hard to make it a weekly podcast. I really, really did. And I was able to sustain that for about 14, 15 weeks or so. However, for some reason, my daytime job responsibilities amped up big time during the summer. And by the time I make it home, both my mind and my body are exhausted. That doesn't mean I'm not keeping up to date on what's happening, of course, as I remain active on social media. But in order for me to devote my full time and concentration on Left of Lansing, I'd have to quit my job and make a little income from this podcast. The technical advisor again says, yeah, you can do that, but you have to make money, or at least close to what you're making now. That's a demand that she's put on me, and I understand. She, too, would love it if I could give my full time and attention to this podcast, which is why she has suggested perhaps I think about a Patreon account for me. Maybe. I don't know. I'll look into it. Maybe in the near future. In any case, I just wanted to give you a brief update as to why my podcasts have decreased over the last few months. But while the podcasts have decreased, I'm promising you, everybody, I'm still following how Michigan's right-wing Republican Party is stubbornly pushing forward with its failed agenda despite getting trounced at the polls last year. Now, I have not spoken with you since Governor William Milliken passed away a few weeks ago. And, you know, while Milliken was a Republican, I don't think it's a stretch to say that Milliken would be considered an AOC socialist today, especially in terms of his concerns to protect Michigan's environment. Milliken spearheaded the push to make Michigan the first state to ban DDT and PCB, and he eventually became victorious in getting a bottle return law passed. Now, think about it. Today's Republican Party is so nuts, is so right-wing, is so out there they would view those policies as communist. Unreal. That's how far that party has gone. Whenever people long for the days of when politics were more civil, well, I've got news for you. Those days are gone. Progressives tried to be civil for 40 years or so. What happened? They got trounced. Election after election. The right-wing infrastructure, backed by corporate money, started playing dirty after Richard Nixon's impeachment. Actually, you know what? You could say it started earlier with Barry Goldwater in 1964. But the right wing has dominated politically for decades while we, on the progressive side, tried being civil. I mean, it was just 20 years ago when Democratic President Bill Clinton proudly declared the era of big government was over. I mean, he was proud to celebrate that. And he was proud to say he ended welfare as we knew it. Now, that was the 90s, I understand, and Democrats had taken a shellacking at the polls. It made a little bit of sense as to why Clinton and the Democrats latched onto Wall Street for survival while unions got destroyed by right-wing republicanism. But what did Clinton get in return for being civil? What did Clinton and the Democrats get in return for turning more corporate? What did Clinton get for ending welfare? Or what did Clinton get for ending Glass-Steagall, which tore down the wall separating banking from investment banking, which led to the 2008 crash? I mean, what did Bill Clinton get for all of that? Bill Clinton got impeached by Republicans. We then got rewarded of 8 years of George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, more trickle-down, handouts to the rich donor base, environmental deregulation, the costly Iraq War, the insane and unconstitutional war on terror, spying, torture, policies of hatred towards LGBTQ Americans, all in the name of compassionate conservatism. You remember that? By the way, let's go back and see how many times the press hounded Bush and Cheney on how they'd pay for tax cuts, on how they would pay for the Iraq War, or bank deregulation, or environmental deregulation, or spying programs. I'm going to say that question was barely asked. You know, it always makes me laugh whenever I hear people long for the days of civility. It makes me laugh because in my lifetime, and I'm pretty certain for many years before my lifetime, there was a section of this country that never did believe in civility. Well, they liked or professed civility as long as their little world order was intact. As long as the structural hierarchy of rich white men retained power, they could stand to be civil. One only has to read our history books or go to a YouTube video to find out how civil some Americans were when black Americans had the radical notion of eating from the same establishments as their white counterparts. It was not that long ago. And the Richard Nixon, Pat Buchanan Southern strategy of 50 years ago is still in play today. Reagan used it, George H. Bush used it, George W. Bush used it, and Donald Trump is using it. You know, I've come to the conclusion after watching Trump rallies that many people we thought were decent might not actually be all that decent or civil. I know, call me crazy. But the right-wing white identity politics goes from blaming black Americans to one minute to blaming Hispanics the next minute, or they'll blame Muslims the next minute and how we have to ban them, and then they'll move on and say, hey, you know what, we've got to hate on gay people for a while. Hating is all they've got. Because the right-wing power structure in this country needs the people divided in order to achieve its ultimate goal. Its ultimate goal, ladies and gentlemen, is redistribution of wealth to the top. That's why Reagan passed regressive tax cuts. That's why Bush and Cheney passed them. And that's why the current occupant in the White House, along with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, worked quickly to pass the GOP tax scam in 2017. It was one of the first things that they passed, one of the first major pieces of legislation. Why? Because its ultimate goal is redistribution of wealth to the top. It's what those guys are sent there to do. They work to provide massive socialism to their rich donor base while telling the rest of us to pull ourselves from our bootstraps. And when they fear that message is failing as everybody feels the weight of economic inequality through stagnant wages or high healthcare costs or insurmountable student debt, they shout how we need, I don't know, a wall. That's right. A wall will make everything better. Don't pay attention to our crippling economic policies that we've enacted on the masses. No, 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 no. Here's a nice, shiny wall that that Mexico will pay for. Our friend Chris Savage from the outstanding Michigan progressive blog Eclectablog interviewed economist Gabriel Zuckman from the University of California, Berkeley on his GOTMFV show. Please, 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 please subscribe to this podcast. The GOTMFV show is fantastic. Chris and his staff do an awesome job. Anyway, Zuckman, along with fellow Berkeley economist Emmanuel Saez, released a book called The Triumph of Injustice. Now, Zuckman talked about this book and some of the economic realities that they were able to find in their research on the GOTMFV show. Essentially, he talked about how their research found that for the first time in a century, America's 400 richest families now pay lower taxes than people in the middle class. That's the ball game, ladies and gentlemen. That's the ball game. The rich, right-wing Republican donor base didn't even just think in terms of national policy either. No, they enacted similar measures in states across the nation. And the DeVos-bought GOP has done a fine job of starving public funds in Michigan so that the elites can enjoy more cash and more power. That's the ballgame. And whenever we, the people, get a little victory here or there, like Obamacare, for example, the DeVos and Michigan Chamber of Commerce-backed GOP passed draconian work requirements on hardworking Michiganders who qualify for the Medicaid expansion, for example. Or they demand working Michiganders to undergo invasive drug testing to receive public funds, while, of course, never demanding really the same for themselves since, you know, they also accept public funds, you know, our tax dollars pay for their salaries. You see, the Trump GOP isn't anything new. They are who we've always thought they were. So when Trump is booed at a World Series game and the crowd there chants, "Lock him up," you have to understand this. You just have to understand this because knowing everything that the GOP stands for, knowing everything that the rich right-wing donor base has thrown at Democrats for decades, you have to understand why it drives me freaking insane whenever I hear someone like Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Coons lament about how we need civility. Here's what Chris Coons said, and I quote, "Well, forgive me, I'm enough of a sort of traditionalist about our institutions that even at a time when there is a lot that our president does that I find disturbing, offensive, and unconventional, I have a hard time with the idea of a crowd on a globally televised sporting event chanting, 'Lock him up,' about our president. I frankly think the office of the president deserves respect even when the actions of our president don't." Coons said that, by the way, on CNN. What an absolute loser mentality Chris Coons has on the entire situation that 99% of Americans are facing right now. How can the National Democratic Party claim that the current occupant in the White House is a threat to national security, but then demand that we have to be civil? Demand that, hey, don't you dare boo that guy that you consider to be a threat to national security. No, stand up and give him a golf clap. Chris Coons is the embodiment of the corporate Democratic establishment that's used to losing. Do you remember how the corporate press lauded Coons and former Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake for their careful deliberation and delaying the vote for the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination? I mean, I remember when 60 Minutes actually spent 15 minutes talking to both Coons and Flake about how awesome it was that you saw these two guys work together. And what did they accomplish? Delaying a vote for a week. Oh, and everyone celebrated that, too. It was awesome. And what did Chris Coons get in delaying that vote for a week? What did he get for all of his hard work? What did Chris Coons get for all of his civility? Jeff Flake ended up voting for Kavanaugh. But hey, at least Chris Coons was civil. This week, Democratic presidential candidate, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, released her Medicare for All plan. Now, I shared some opinions on social media about how I didn't think Elizabeth Warren had to give a detailed plan. She could have been vague about it. That's fine. And besides, anyone who espoused or believed that, let's say Mexico, for example, was going to pay for a wall, those people really have no business getting all verklempt over Warren's plan. But she still released the plan and did it in a way that reframed the debate. Instead of talking about taxes, she's forcing those who are against such a plan, including those in her own party, Nancy Pelosi, to explain how paying for high deductibles and premiums are still worse than raising capital gains taxes on the right-wing donor base. Plus, let's say Medicare for All can't pass the Senate right now, even if the Democrats do gain control of the Senate, which, by the way, that's also imperative that we take control of the Senate. Isn't that a good starting point for negotiations? Think about it. I mean, the compromise would be then creating a public option. But of course, that would mean negotiating with strength and conviction, something that is a complete foreign concept to some Democrats. Do you want to hear what it's like to debate with strength, moral clarity, conviction, and intelligence? Here, listen to New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on CNN this week, clearly explaining why Medicare for All would be better than what we've currently got here in the United States.
First of all, the thing that we need to realize is people talk about the sticker shock of Medicare for All. They do not talk about the sticker shock of the cost of our existing system. You know, in a Koch brothers funded study, if any study is going to try to be a little bit slanted, it would be one funded by the Koch brothers. It shows that Medicare for All is actually much cheaper than the current system that we pay right now. And let's not forget that the reason that the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act is because they ruled that each of these monthly payments that everyday Americans make is a tax. And so while it may not seem like we pay that tax on April 15th, we pay it every single month, or we do pay it tax season if we don't buy, these plans off of the exchange. So we're paying for this system. We Americans have the sticker shock of healthcare as it is. And what we're also not talking about is why aren't we incorporating the cost of all the funeral expenses of those who die because they can't afford access to healthcare? That is part of the cost of our system. Why don't we talk about the cost of reduced productivity because of people who need to go on disability, because of people who are not able to participate in our economy, because they have because they're having issues like diabetes or they don't have access to the healthcare that they need. I think at the end of the day, we see that this is not a pipe dream. Every other developed nation in the world does this. Why can't America? And that is the question that we need to ask. We have done these things before. We write unlimited blank checks for war. We just wrote a $2 trillion check for that tax cut, the GOP tax cut, and nobody asked those folks how are they going to pay for it. So my question is, why is it that our pockets are only empty when it comes to education and health care for our kids? Why are pockets only empty when we talk about 100% renewable energy that is going to save this planet and allow our children to thrive? We only have empty pockets when it comes to the morally right things to do. But when it comes to tax cuts for billionaires and when it comes to unlimited war, we seem to be able to invent that that money very easily. And to me, it belies a lack of moral priorities that people have right now, especially the Republican Party.
That's what fighting sounds like. But currently, we have a House Speaker who derides Medicare for All, who derides the Green New Deal, who derides progressive thought. We're not in the 1990s anymore. We're not in the 1970s anymore during the days of William Milliken. The corporate right wing of this country has taken us to the brink. Just look at Michigan's roads, education, and high Great Lakes water levels, and you'll see how the right wing has damaged this state. It's right there in plain view for all of us to see and experience each and every day. I'm sorry, but I'm tired of being civil. I'm tired of being nice. And I'm glad that there are others out there who are just as tired and feel the sense of urgency, which is why we had lots of progressive women win state House seats, win state Senate seats, and win the Attorney General's race here in Michigan, and win the Secretary of State's office in Michigan, and also win the governor's seat. The corporate right-wing power structure demands us to remain civil because that's how they keep their power. They want you to sit down and shut up. But that's not what we're doing, especially here in Michigan. And that's why Governor Gretchen Whitmer knows that while she's hamstrung by the gerrymandered Republican legislative majority, she still has a few tools in her arsenal to fight back, like, for instance, directing the state's Labor Department to develop a new rule raising the overtime threshold for salaried employees. That's a good move. That's bold strategy. That's moving forward. That's progressing. That's making Michigan a place that people will say, you know what, I might want to live there. Now, I'm going to be honest, Governor Whitmer may have thought that after she worked with the DeVos Chamber of Commerce-backed Republicans on passing that horrific auto insurance reform bill, and reform is in quotations, that maybe she would get something in return, maybe something for road funding. Well, we all know what happened. Republicans gave her nothing. Not one thing in return. Whitmer was civil, and she got burned. But now she's deciding to fight back. Is this a trend? Well, one can only hope, because people are desperate and people need help. Not just here in Michigan, but people need help across the nation. Democrats, please stand up and fight. All we progressives are trying to do is get back to our roots, is to get this country back to where it used to be. That's not radical. That's common sense. Coming up, Christine Berry from Michigan Podcast. You're listening to LOL.
A podcast devoted to helping fix the damn roads, because Pat's tired of dodging potholes. It's the Left of Lansing Podcast. The Left of Lansing Podcast is available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, and of course on leftoflansing.com. Now, back to Pat Johnston.
Thanks again for listening to Left of Lansing for another week. Your support is appreciated. And if you'd like to contact me, my email is leftoflansing@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Twitter @leftoflansing. So about a month ago, a fellow Michigan progressive podcaster was kind enough to highlight the work that I and a handful of others are doing to spread Michigan's progressive message through podcasting. And I think she posted this on International Podcasting Day. And it's because she shared my podcast with her many followers that I became aware of her podcast. Now, that is social networking at its best, ladies and gentlemen. She is part of a trio who co-hosts the smart, informative, and funny podcast known as Michigan Podcast. Her name is Christine Berry, and she's agreed to take a little time out from her busy schedule to join me here this week. Christine, welcome to the Left of Lansing Podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you, Pat. I appreciate you having me on. I'm so excited that I get to talk to you. I've been listening to you since your inaugural podcast, and it's great stuff, and I was very happy to promote you then and anytime.
Oh, thank you very much for your kind words. Look, Christine, for some who might not know much about Michigan Podcast, can you give us a bit of an overview?
Yeah, sure. So Michigan Podcast is a weekly podcast. We publish every Monday, and we are only able to do that because we have the wonderful support of Walt Sorg, who has been in broadcasting forever, but prior to that was in the state legislature. He was employed in comms or something. I'm not real clear on it, but after that, he went into broadcasting, and he's great. He does all of our production audio-wise. And we have Amy Kerr Harden, who is, in my opinion, one of the best investigative bloggers. She blogged at Democracy Tree for a long time, and now she is writing for Northern Express, I think is what it is. And she's just great. And then I take care of the website and I start Twitter fights. So that's my role. You know, Pat, as you know, it's tough to stay on the schedule. And this is really our second try at this. We ran for about a year back in 2014, 2015, and just couldn't get on a consistent schedule because we were all so busy. And Walt just started to get involved in Voters Not Politicians. He played a big role in that movement. So we had to give it up for a few years, but now we're back and it seems to be going really well, and we've been on schedule. And so we're excited about the way the show is going, and we're excited to get to know all of the other wonderful podcasters out there who are just getting started as well.
I understand exactly where you're coming from. Sometimes for those of us who do podcasting, we also have other things that we're doing, other day jobs, and it can be tough to really get on a regular schedule. But I think that it is so important that we have voices like you and Amy's and Walt's, because I'm going to be quite blunt. Getting a progressive voice on terrestrial radio is tough. It just is. It's just the way the business is set up. They don't really want to hear progressive voices too much. And so I think the power of podcasting is the future, especially for progressives out there. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely agree. And it's not tough to get into it, although it might seem intimidating at first. But really, anyone can get involved in podcasting and get their perspective out there. And on the progressive side, years ago, we had such great success in just taking over blogging, really, and just being the dominant voice in political blogging. And I hope that we do the same thing with podcasting. And I'll just put it out there right now that any Michigan progressive podcaster who wants to reach out to us, we're happy to cross-promote and do what we can to just elevate you guys. And, you know, hopefully we can all elevate each other and share these messages because it's so important. And to your point, corporate dominance of broadcast radio, it's a tough battle. I think we need each other.
We're speaking with Christine Berry from Michigan Politicast here on the Left of Lansing podcast this week. Now, Christine, you've been involved in Michigan politics for quite some time, correct?
On the outside, right?
Yeah.
I've blogged for a long, long time. I was an investigative blogger locally. And then when Governor Granholm was elected, I started blogging state politics and the budget fights and what the state Senate and House were doing. And that was so interesting. It's just, it also kind of turns your stomach to have that kind of historical knowledge and know that you know more than like the Lee Chatfields of the world who were not watching back then and are going to be termed out a few years. So he's one of the ones I pick fights with on Twitter because I'm like, dude, I'm sorry you don't know all of these things you're tweeting about. But I have to correct you because I was writing about this back then. I've been watching and studying, and it's so fascinating, and it's so important, Pat, that people pay more attention to what's going on in Lansing. And, you know, really every level of government is important, but Lansing, what they do there touches every aspect of your life in some way. What the masses tend to hear, because everybody's busy living their lives, they don't have time to pay attention to stuff like we do. And what they tend to hear, partisan bickering. They think everything is partisan bickering, both sides this, both sides that. No, that's what people want you to hear so that you disengage. You need to engage. You need to listen to what's really going on there. The partisan bickering can be really important stuff. If somebody, one party is trying to take away a right that you have and the other party is fighting for you, yeah, that's more than bickering, Pat. And that's something people need to pay attention to. And where do they get that news? Our local news media, our papers are already stretched so thin and being stretched even more, really. I mean, resource depleted. Where are they going to get that? It's not for people like you and me.
No, not at all. And you're preaching to the choir, especially when it comes to the importance of state government. And I'll admit, Christine, back when I was in college in the 1990s, I mean, I was always politically engaged somewhat, but I paid more attention to what was happening with Bill Clinton and the impeachment, for instance, or things that were happening on the national level. And it wasn't until I got into my first news reporting job in 2001 on a local station that I realized, huh, look at all this stuff that is happening in Michigan alone. And this is where change happens rather quickly, faster than it can happen on the national level. And I think that it is up to progressives out there, in not just in Michigan, but I think in every state, to explain this to people as much as they can, to say, hey, yes, everything that's happening with Donald Trump and everything that's happening with the Republicans and Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats, very, very important, no doubt about it. But change happens faster on the local level, and you've got to get involved on the state level if you want to make that change happen for you and make your state better.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that really underscores your point there is that on the conservative side, you have institutions like the State Policy Network that are just churning out templates for legislation that support this conservative ideology, right, that has been doing what we've watched it do for years, right? Shift wealth to the upper 1 and 2%, strip away reproductive rights and all of these things that we rally against. The conservatives have invested millions in making sure that it's easy to get those laws passed.
They learned the lesson, and I think this goes back to, you know, from the 60s and 70s. They learned the lesson that maybe in order to generate some buzz, in a way to generate change, you have to start more at the local levels. And that included winning your school board seats, winning your city commission seats, county commission seats, and then working your way up to state government. And then you'll be able to push an agenda on the national level. And I'm hoping that progressives, maybe thanks to President Trump getting into office, are finally learning that lesson. It took us 3 or 4 decades, but it might be sinking in.
I think so. I think that the election of President Trump was so offensive to so many people that they felt compelled to some kind of action. We've seen kind of this burgeoning grassroots for lately. Voters, not politicians, I think did a great job showing us the way of showing us what a true grassroots movement could be. And then the election of LaVora Barnes for Michigan Democratic Party chair. She has been wonderful at really working to cultivate those voters, those individuals who can get involved in wherever their passion takes them, not necessarily the party, but the awareness of what you can do. LaVora has been very good at that, as well as reorganizing the voter access network and all of that. So I think Trump really motivated people. I know after he was elected, at the first county Democratic Party meeting we had out here in Shiawassee, there were like 60 people who showed up. And they showed up to ask about things like what's going to happen to their prescriptions. And I mean, there were so many engaged people who didn't stay engaged, but showed up because they were just shocked. And so it is kind of thanks to that happened. And also, I think just thanks to the fact that we're slowly waking up to what the conservatives have been doing over, like you said, it's been decades in the making of them taking time to organize at the local level. They wrote books. They went and talked to churches about social issues, and they did all of these things so that now they'd be in this position that they're in.
We're speaking with Christine Berry from Michigan Policast on the Left of Lansing podcast here this week, since we are talking about the election of President Trump and how that may have galvanized a lot of people to get involved in state politics for the first time. I talked with former Michigan Democratic Party Chair Mark Brewer a few months ago, and while he did credit Michigan's progressive movement on achieving some great victories, including those 3 ballot initiatives that you just brought up, I mean, he did stress that having Donald Trump as president played a key role. Do you think that Trump was the main impetus as to why Democrats, including progressive Democrats, experienced some success in 2018? Or do you think there always was a solid progressive faction in Michigan, but we're just lying dormant for some reason for a long time?
I think that progressives have been dormant, like you said. I think we took it for granted. We took for granted that the union would vote for us. We took for granted that Wayne County and Detroit, and you know, there were certain bastions, right, certain strongholds that we thought would come out for us no matter what. So we took those things for granted. You know, I think the polling kind of, we took that as accurate, right? So we were comfortable going into it. And then this horrible, horrible man was elected. Like I said, it was compelling. It was so offensive to so many people that this thing got elected. Don't mean any disrespect to the presidency, but I don't have any respect for the man. And so people just had to do something.
Yeah, well, we are where we are, and I'm not going to kind of rehash exactly everything that happened in the past, because regardless, we got people engaged in Michigan's political system, which was badly and sorely needed. We needed our progressive base to get fired up once again. We needed our progressive base to understand exactly what was on the line, and I think that has happened. Everybody did come out in 2018, and that's because of Trump's presidency. We got Governor Whitmer. We got Dana Nessel to be our attorney general. We won those ballot initiatives. Those are good things. I remember talking to a guest on the podcast a while ago, and I'm forgetting who said this. Well, it doesn't really matter. But I remember asking them, well, yes, we got a President Trump, but now we were able to get some major victories in Michigan in 2018. Maybe it was worth it. Maybe that was a silver lining. And my guest said, yeah, it's good that we woke up here in Michigan, but it's still quite a high price to pay to have a President Trump in office. So I guess they still have a point there.
Yeah, well, you know, in addition to Trump, Pat, I think Bernie Sanders did a lot to really get some people engaged who didn't think there was anyone out there for them.
Yeah.
You know, along comes Bernie talking about these things like student debt and Medicare for all, and that was something that they were waiting for. So I think it's a combination of things.
Absolutely. We're speaking with
Chris. But I agree, high price.
High price to pay. We're speaking with Christine Berry from Michigan Policast on the Left of Lansing podcast this week. You know, we were talking about those ballot initiatives that passed and passed overwhelmingly here in Michigan just a couple of years ago. I was wondering, do you think progressives should push for a graduated income tax on the ballot for 2020?
Well, I do think we should push for it. I don't know when. You know, obviously, like right now, I don't know what else is going to be on the ballot, and I don't know what the actual landscape, what the reality on the ground will be, but the progressive income tax has great support across the state.
Yeah.
See, we talked to Bernie Porn yesterday. He was actually a guest on our show that published today, and he said that it would raise about half of what we needed to fix the roads if we were to do something like that, if I remember correctly. It's one of the ways that we could really fix the structural problems in the state. I mean, we have serious problems in the way we fund our state. It's just broken. And I think that's why Governor Whitmer is in such a state that she had to go out and say, okay, we need a 45-cent gas tax increase. She doesn't want to tax people 45 cents a gallon. But something has to be done here, and she can't just change the Constitution. So a gas tax seems like the way to go. And unfortunately, you know, it's just as popular, I think, as everyone thought it would be. But the progressive income tax does have some support. The chamber would oppose it, of course. I don't think it would affect that many people, though. I mean, really, you have to be a certain income level.
Yeah, right.
Before it would matter.
I think you brought up a great point that Governor Whitmer, she's been in Lansing for many years. She's a veteran. She knew that 45-cent gas tax proposal was never going to be popular. I always looked at it, Christine, that was just her way of saying, everybody, this is how much money we need to raise to fix just our roads. That's just for starters. And I understand why, of course, it was never going to be popular. But like you brought up, the progressive income tax proposal, whenever you see polling on it, it does pretty well because there are many Michiganders who say, they look at that and say, okay, that's actually a bit more fair because a 45-cent gas tax, for instance, that's going to hurt somebody a lot more who's earning $25,000, let's say, and has to travel about 30 miles to work, whereas somebody, you know, who's making over $200,000 or a corporation doesn't really affect them as much. They look at the graduated or progressive income tax proposals as a lot more fair for the entire society.
I agree. I mean, personally, I think a graduated income tax is more fair. It doesn't, you know, if I pay more in tax, I don't get more stuff for it or anything like that. But that's not what a tax system is about. And, you know, I'm not one of these selfish nine balls that isn't willing to pay more taxes if I have to help fix our problems. So I don't have a problem with that. I don't even know where I would fall in this tax, you know, in the tier or anything. But it's certainly easier to swallow, if you will, than 45 cents a gallon. I mean, there's a lot of people who don't like that. And Michigan does rely on tourism, and you want people to be out and enjoying the fall colors, you know, or the summer beaches or something. So I understand that. You know, another thing that, Pat, that was interesting was that when she announced that 45 cent gas tax, I really thought that by doing so, she basically gave the Republicans in the legislature a huge opportunity to do anything other than that and be the winner.
Hmm.
Like anything else you came up with that wasn't more than a 45 cent gas tax increase would have made you look good, but they couldn't even come up with a single penny increase of revenue when they have to know that we need it. You know, I assume that even though they don't have a lot of experience, many of them because of term limits or whatever, they have to be able to look at that and say, oh my God, we need money, and not think, well, let's cut the tether program. Let's lay off the prison guards. Let's cut cybersecurity, which is what they did to get their money. But, you know, they didn't take that opportunity, and now we're in a bind, I guess.
We're speaking with Christine Berry from Michigan Policast on the LOL podcast here this week. All right, since you brought up term limits, I just wanted to, this story just kind of blew my mind when I saw it last week, and I know it's something that you talk about on the Michigan Policast this week, and it has to deal with how there's this joint effort by Michigan Republicans, the legislative leaders especially, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and then the group Voters Not Politicians, which spearheaded the anti-gerrymandering ballot proposal that easily won in 2018. They're all working together now to end term limits. Now, it's just strange to me, Christine, because not only did these same Republicans and the chamber fight to kill that anti-gerrymandering initiative last year, but conservatives were the one who led the charge for term limits back in the 80s and the 90s. And now these Republicans in the chamber are currently pushing for the courts to, you know, block that redistricting commission from even forming. So what is going on? Why is VNP working, do you think, with Republicans in the Chamber of Commerce to end term limits?
I think the time has finally come that people understand the destructive nature of term limits. You know, the term limits are popular in the public because the public just don't like state government. Even if they like their own person, they don't like everybody else. And so they're like, term limits, get them all out of there. Well, the problem is that's not enough time for people to develop a historical viewpoint of government, to really think about, okay, how is this going to work in the future, to build the relationships they need so that two people can go into a room and trust each other. I mean, Governor Whitmer has a lot of relationships in Lansing, but a lot of the people who are in the House and Senate now never served with her. And if they had, maybe they would be more willing to trust her when she says she will or won't do something. And maybe she would not have been so quick to go out and, I think she took some shots at them that she didn't have to take. And, you know, she was always in the minority. I think she was kind of trained to do that. But as governor, that might not have served her well in this budget debate.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, with term limits, what we did is force ignorance. And the institutional knowledge that you develop in the legislature goes straight into lobbying, where these guys and women, I mean, obviously, are making six-figure incomes to go back in and use the knowledge to, quote-unquote, teach the legislators how things work, or to have quote-unquote educational luncheons with them or something. But it's from a perspective that doesn't represent the public at all. It represents that special interest. It's got to stop. And from the Michigan Chamber's perspective, I think that what they're looking at is how good government can help their membership, and good government would help with things like infrastructure in Michigan, better broadband, better roads, all of that kind of thing. I mean, there's just too many special interests at work, which means that the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which has a membership that has so many different industries in it, all of their membership is impacted in some way or another, and someone's always getting a negative end in when someone else gets positive. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's a natural fit for voters, not politicians. And from the chamber's perspective, and all of the legislators on the left and the right, I mean, they're just saying that from a practical perspective, we need better policy coming out of Lansing, and the only way to do that is to stop this constant flow of people into special interests and to really start to have some people who are going to mature in Lansing. As long as they're taking care of their constituency, they'll be reelected, and if they're not, then they'll be defeated.
Don't get me wrong. I'm also against term limits too, Christine, but I sometimes think that progressives get burned whenever they decide to work with conservative or conservative groups. For example, you know, Governor Whitmer didn't run on passing the chamber-backed auto insurance reform bill. She didn't. Some Michiganders are realizing now that since they passed that bill that, yeah, we had high auto insurance rates compared to the rest of the nation, but wait a second, we also had better catastrophic coverage, and now that'll be gone in a few years. I understand that Governor Whitmer and other Democrats who are in purple districts fell under the pressure that we had to pass, I guess, something, but at what cost? And I was even willing, Christine, I was even willing to give the governor the benefit of the doubt. I thought maybe she was playing some kind of Jedi mind tricks, and that she'd pass this bill in return for Michigan Republicans giving her something in terms of road funding, but they gave her nothing. That is the kind of stuff that drives me and other progressives nuts. We hate always seeing Democrats giving away the store and then getting nothing in return.
I agree. And that is something that sticks in my mind when I see things like people working with Republicans or the chamber to, you know, the thing with term limits, it's like, okay, if we go into the thing with term limits, what exactly are we giving up because we're working with these people? I don't want to give up anything anymore. We've given up enough. I think you're right about the auto insurance. I, at the time, thought, Governor Whitmer, there's no way that this is a bad move for us because she knows, like, she's the smartest person in every room in Lansing, in my opinion, because she's been there so long and she's a student of it.
Yeah.
The outcome was something that I just couldn't believe was intentional. I don't know if that was a deal she made and she got screwed over. I don't know. But I do think that the way that she's handling the budget now may be showing that she learned a lesson from that. And she's not going to negotiate in good faith just based on what you say you're going to do. She wants to have some kind of leverage in the negotiation. So I don't know if that's true. That's just what it looks like from from my perspective.
You know what, though?
And my,
I can't disagree with you. That's a pretty good way, that's a pretty good way of looking at it, and I do hope you're right on that, because it does seem like, with, in terms of the budget, that she's using a lot of tools at her disposal to fight back on this one. And maybe you're right. Maybe she did learn her lesson after the auto insurance reform, or quote-unquote reform bill. I know we got to let you go, but I just want to bring this up. On a recent Michigan podcast, your colleague Walt Sora covered the death of former Governor William Milliken. Of course, he was very, very popular. And Walt talked about how times were different during the Milliken era in Michigan. And, you know, it was a time, as he reminded everybody, of when politics maybe weren't as personal and legislators sometimes found some common ground. But we're not there anymore, right? I mean, those days are over and those days will never come back. I mean, in fact, Christine, if Governor Milliken were a governor today, he'd be a Democrat because they would consider him a socialist, especially on his environmental views. Do you think it is time that Democrats will realize, look, those days of the 60s and 70s are over? It ended after the Nixon days. It continued with Roger Ailes and Reagan and then the Bushes. And now, of course, with Donald Trump, that we have to fight fire with fire and we have to fight back.
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of talk after George W. Bush won that the Democrats were playing checkers while Republicans played chess. And they used structural tools, not just messaging, not just policy, but structural tools at their disposal at different levels, voter suppression and getting ballot initiatives. I remember they put those big gay bashing ballot initiatives on in certain battle states. And so they used these tools to do that. We're like, wow, we were just played, man. We were just so outplayed in this. Now, could a Governor Milliken really survive at that level? No. And it's a shame to say that's just the case. You know, you mentioned his passion for the environment. That's a shame that that's a left versus right issue.
I know.
I don't understand, you know, because so many people, conservatives, they love being outside. They love the outdoors. They fish, they hunt, they camp. Then they support people who will turn around and gut the protections for those things that they love. And I, again, can go back to the beginning of our conversation where we talk about people not staying engaged or informed. But to get back to Governor Milliken, I think that there are Governor Millikens all over the place, but they are on school boards and county boards and city councils. I'm on our local school board here. You know, it's a nonpartisan seat, but we all know what we believe. We all know who each other are. And we work together really well. And it's because we are so close to what we are there to do. You know, we meet in the school. We talk to the people who work there. We talk to the families. We are so in touch with what we're supposed to be doing that it's really just all about getting the job done in the best way possible. And I think if you were able to take that environment and that kind of working relationship to Lansing, there would be Governor Milliken's there too, but you just can't do it anymore. Everything's too caustic. There's just too much at work against us to be able to do that.
Christine, thank you very much for being on the Left of Lansing podcast. How can people find the Michigan podcast?
Well, we're online at www.michiganpolicast.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at MIPolicast. And if you want to reach out to us, you can reach us on email at MIPolicast@gmail.com.
Cool. And the podcast is posted, is it Monday mornings it's posted?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's every Monday morning, unless something special happens, like a budget announcement on Monday afternoon, then we'll publish on Tuesday.
And if people would like to follow you on Twitter, Christine?
I am at Christine Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, on Twitter. And I'm also Christine Barry on Facebook if you want to hit me up there, although I'm on Twitter more because that's where it's just more fun to fight with people.
Absolutely. Yes, I agree with you completely. All right. Well, well, Christine, thank you very much, and keep fighting the good fight, and I hope that you can come back sometime in the future.
Yeah, I hope so too. Thanks, Pat. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. Upset with something you've heard? Did Pat say something you think is ignorant, stupid, or arrogant? Or do you actually agree with something Pat said on the podcast? Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
I really enjoyed that talk with Christine Barry from Michigan Podcast. You can find Michigan Podcast very easily, but I've also provided a link to it on my blog, leftoflansing.com. You'll find that link with the post of this week's podcast. Time now for the Left of Lansing Last Call. A few weeks ago, Ron French from the remarkable Bridge Magazine online publication posted a story about how fewer young Michiganders want to be teachers anymore. French shared these rather disturbing statistics. He says, enrollment at Michigan's teacher preparation programs dropped 70% in 8 years. There were 16,000 fewer college students majoring in K-12 education degree programs in 2016 and 17 than there were 2008 through 2009, according to data from the U.S. Department of Education. Those 16,000 fewer potential teachers are the equivalent of one-sixth of Michigan's current public school teaching workforce. While federal data are not available for the current school year, enrollment in teacher preparation programs at Michigan State University, Central Michigan University, and the University of Michigan, three of the state's largest educators and future teachers, have continued to decline or have remained flat since 2016 and 2017. All right, so that was Ron French from The Bridge Magazine. And yeah, I read these stats, and it's not rocket science to me as to why this is happening. And in fact, Ron French noted the reason in his piece on The Bridge Magazine: low salaries and negative perceptions of teaching are driving Michigan college students away from teacher prep programs, hobbling efforts to improve the state's struggling schools. Fewer teachers with four-year education degrees has also meant more Michigan classrooms led by long-term substitutes who generally have far less training. You know, it's almost as if this was a long-term plan by the DeVos-backed corporate for-profit charter school structure. Teacher pay has dropped also, which boggles the mind here in Michigan, because in order to truly attract new businesses to the state, an educated workforce would kind of help, would it not? And now teachers have to deal with this one-size-fits-all third-grade reading proficiency law that will soon go into effect. It's a law that was passed, by the way, by Michigan Republicans and former Governor Rick Snyder that holds students back if they can't read at a third-grade level. In third grade, by the way, and this is all sort of kind of confusing, because for years I was told by the right wing how they were against government telling school districts what they can and cannot do. Anyway, here's Democratic State Senator Dana Polhanke from Livonia. Senator Polhanke is a former teacher, by the way, and this is what she posted on her Twitter feed, offering yet again, as progressives do, some common sense ideas.
More than 5,000 third graders in Michigan are at risk of being held back in school because some folks think the one-size-fits-all approach works for every child. We need new ideas and innovation in Lansing. I'm State Senator Dana Polhanke. I have 19 years of teaching experience, and I can promise you this: Michigan's third grade reading law is not innovation. It's testing and punishing. It's time we trust our teachers and schools to determine who to retain and when.
It's time to listen to the teachers instead of the DeVos family.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you are hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to my favorite progressive voice, Pat Johnston.
Well, I hope it was worth the wait to listen for this next episode of the Left of Lansing podcast. Sorry I was away for a few weeks, but hey, I think it turned out to be pretty good this week, especially because of Christine Berry from Michigan Polycast. And as I've told you already a couple of times, please subscribe to Michigan Polycast. They do a superb job in providing a weekly update on what's happening on the Michigan political scene, and they do it with a progressive bent. Trust me, it is a great, great podcast. Coming up on the next podcast, I'll be talking with somebody who's been on this show before and who's decided to make another run to get a seat in Lansing. This is a progressive champion in Michigan, and we ought to back this person. That is coming up on the next Left of Lansing podcast. In the meantime, as I always tell you at the end of each and every podcast, and it's become a theme, I believe, on this podcast, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston. Just kidding, this thing isn't researched. And broadcasted by Pat Johnston. Technical assistance provided by the wonderful Dr. Heather. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information and Pat's musical taste, if you can handle it. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.